Welcome, everyone, to Attorneys Are Human 2, Episode 24, Climate Change Part 1, The Living Changing Planet, featuring political and environmental expert Dr. Andre Fladell, the Prince of Palm Beach County. I'm Steve Wallace. I'm your host. We're also joined by our co-host, Selena Music. We're both of the Wallace Law Group. Let's get right to it. Welcome, everybody, to this episode of Attorneys Are Human 2. We have a true pleasure today. We have our political and climate change expert, Dr. Andre Fladell, the Prince of Palm Beach County. And once again, it's truly a pleasure to have you on today, Prince.
Thank you so much.
And so we are going to do this episode in two parts. So you're going to be listening to part one, and then ultimately you're going to download part two. My first question to you, Prince, is what is your view on ocean rising?
Oceans are rising, but I'm going to focus for the minute on the Atlantic Ocean, which is most germane to us. And exactly. The Atlantic Ocean is considered to be rising more than all the other oceans. It's estimated at the current time that the Atlantic Ocean is rising at about 4 inches every 10 years. Some say 4.3, some say more, but let's take things on a conservative level for this entire program. But one of the reasons why the ocean is rising has to do with the Greenland ice shelf. When you have a glass of water and you have ice in it and the ice melts, the water doesn't overflow. So when the ice melts in the Arctic, it's melting over the ocean. It doesn't really contribute to the ocean rise as much as people would like to say it does. But when ice melts off of a land shelf, then the ice pours, and it pours straight into the Atlantic Ocean from Greenland. From 1900 to the year 2000, Greenland lost 8 miles of its ice shelf. That's over 100 years. From 2001 to 2019, in 18 years, it lost 9 miles. So in the last 18 years, it's lost more of its ice shelf than it did in the 100 preceding. That fresh water drips into the Atlantic Ocean. Second component is called glacial rebound. If you were to lay on a mattress or put a suitcase on a mattress and leave it there for 6 years, when you take the mattress off the suitcase, there's a dent in the mattress. It doesn't just come right back. But if you watch the mattress over maybe a month, it'll start to come back. Like when you put something on a rug and you've left it there like a couch, there'll be a little dent in the rug. Well, glacial rebound is when the bottom of the ocean and the bottom of where the glaciers were start to rise, and they don't rise in a day, they rise over thousands of years. So a second contributor is something they call forebulge or isotonic adjustment, which is glacial rebound. Third, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, you have something called the Atlantic Ridge. This can be seen from outer space. The Atlantic Ridge is actually a mountain range which is forming, or a ridge forming, in the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean from the Scandinavian North Atlantic to the South Atlantic. This creates also a pressure for the ocean to rise. Fourth thing you have is called land sinking. The East Coast is actually sinking. Part of the East Coast is sand. Part of the East Coast is over water. Part of the East Coast is a porous limestone. And the land on the East Coast of the United States or North America particularly is sinking faster than most other places. The fifth contributing factor to ocean rise is water heat expansion. If you take water and you heat it, it expands. You heat anything chemically, physically, it expands. So there's actually an expansion of ocean rise based on the difference in the water temperature, which is minimal. And even though the water temperature may be only 2 degrees in 50 years, that 2 degrees creates an expansive nature. Remember, the ocean expands 1 inch because of water, because of heat, that's water rise. Next, you have the Antarctic ice shelf, which, like the Greenland ice shelf, is interesting. And you got to remember, Antarctica was originally a forest, and then Antarctica was a desert. And only 34 million years ago did Antarctica actually create an ice shelf, which now is starting to melt and melting nicely. And that's also contributing. The last factor I'd like to mention contributing, before we talk about human involvement, is the Sahara Desert. Now, a lot of people say, why is there Sahara sand in the bottom of the ocean? Because the Sahara Desert was a lake. There was no desert in North Africa. 15,000 years ago, the lake in North Africa was called Megachad. And Megachad was 142,000 square miles. And Megachad was one of the largest freshwater lakes in the world or the planet. And there were dozens and dozens of civilizations that are now found in the Sahara Desert that lived off this lake. So when you see Saharan sand flying across the ocean and landing in South America, and I'll tell you about that, the desert is converting back to the lake system it was 15,000 years ago. In fact, there is considered to be 22 million tons of Saharan sand in South America, and that's said to have fertilized the Amazon rainforest because the phosphorus from the bottom of the lake, which was that desert, is now all over South America, and it's the fertilizer which makes it so fertile. It comes actually from Africa. So lake rise, ocean rise, is not just simply man and his hydrocarbons, which is a component. People who talk about it, environmentalists, people who talk about climate change, need to talk about the Atlantic Ridge and glacial rebound, and they need to talk about the water heat expansion and land sinking and the Saharan sand, but too often they don't.
So when I think of climate change, one of the first things that comes to mind is the Al Gore documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. What do you think about that documentary, An Inconvenient
Truth? It's inconveniently a partial truth and inconveniently a political truth, and it may not be conveniently the total picture, and it was not done for the purpose of the total picture. For example, the planet's 4.5 billion years old. And the question I would ask is, how long has man been here? And the answer is 200,000 years of 4.5 billion.
If the Earth with a B, right?
Billion, B. If, like Donald Trump's money, that kind of billion.
Oh, gotcha.
Okay. Yeah, just kidding. If man was here and the Earth was 24 hours old, man's been on this planet for 3 seconds. But more interesting, his pollution or the Industrial Revolution, which is essentially 100 years, 1920, 1910, the length of the Industrial Revolution is 100 years. That's how long we can argue we've been polluting at some extreme rate. That means if the Earth were 24 hours old, we've been polluting for 0.02 seconds. So if you watch a clock and you stay in a day, you wait till 11:59 midnight, you wait for 59 seconds in the last minute, you go for 98/100th of that second, and the last 200 seconds, that's how long man's been here. We may be speeding up a process, but in no way are we the process, and it's really out of proportion. It took a really good, healthy argument about how we as a population deal with what's about to happen, and it turned it into a political nightmare and a fight over whether it exists or not and who created it. None of that's relevant to the issue of climate change, which is part of a living evolution of a planetary system.
What would you say to those people who say they don't believe in climate change?
I would say they need to look at North America and understand what the Ice Age was and ask what happened to the elephants in North America and ask what happened to saber-toothed tigers in North America. There were lions, there were giant sloths, there were camels are indigent to North America. I'd ask them what happened to these animals. I'd ask them how we've gone through 4 ice ages in the North American, and if there's no climate change, then how did that occur? But we'll get into that if we talk about that.
Something near and dear to our heart, being in Florida and being in South Florida, where we have a lot of environmental benefits. One of the things that I'd like to know is, how is Florida formed and what is Florida made out of?
That's a good question, and that'll go to climate change. Because for those who don't believe in climate change, they're going to have to pretend that Florida always existed and Florida didn't. Florida was created initially by coral reef system. It was a coral reef system that was growing underwater and Florida was submerged. Around the coral reef system, as we know, is 25% of the entire sea population, particularly small fish and shellfish. Well, as these shellfish died and as the skeletons of these fish died and as they gravel and sand started growing up these reefs, thousands and thousands of feet of a system of reefs covered with sand started developing. In the Laurentide Ice Age, which is about 80,000, right, the Laurentide Ice Age, as the glaciers retracted, the water, the fresh water that came out, like when you melt ice on a table, water pours, carried sand and dirt from the Appalachian Ridge, which is the East Coast mountain ridge, and actually covered these reefs. And the reefs kept growing and the dirt kept coming. And Florida emerged as a platform. The platform that emerged originally was 2 or 3 times larger than the state is now. The first time Florida emerged, it was about 340 million years ago. Florida has emerged and submerged 4 different times. So for people who think the environment doesn't change, those are the same people who think Florida's been there and hasn't been under the water and over the water 4 different times. So we have a coral reef system put together with gravel and sand. We have an Appalachian mountain or ridge system, which is washing south from ice age retractions, just the water flows. In northern Florida, you have red clay, which is part of what washed down from the middle America. So that's how Florida comes to be. What's interesting also is North America. And North America is what I just want to go into for a second. North America was a lake. And on the east side of the lake, towards the Atlantic, was a ridge, and the west side was a ridge. There was no Rocky Mountains. What occurred was a plate called the Pacific Plate moved under the North American Plate and lifted it. And think of a soup dish on a table, and you put your hands under the side of a soup dish, and you lift it halfway on one side, and all the water drops out. So the lake dropped into the Atlantic Ocean, and the Rocky Mountains was formed. When the Rocky Mountains was formed, all the soil or most of the dirt to the east was the bottom of this lake, which means it's sedimentary layered dirt. The rocks on the west side are igneous because they were all heat molten lava. So you have a Rocky Mountain system, which was 20,000 feet high. It was igneous on the west and sedimentary on the right, confirming it was under an ocean or under a lake on the east side and that how this plate came about. The question is, what's happening to the Rocky Mountains if you don't believe in climate change? The Rocky Mountains is 14,000 to 13,000 feet high on average, not 20,000. That means the Rocky Mountains theoretically is in a collapse, and mountains either collapse or they grow. The Rocky Mountain system is in a collapsing state. How do we know it was 20,000 feet before, and how do we know how fast it's collapsing? If you look at the leaves in Florida, you'll note that the leaves in Florida have smooth ridges. If you look at leaves in Canada, you'll see they have ridges all over them, like maple leaves. If you determine the leaf structure and the ridge system, you can project the height, the cold, and the weather at which that leaf was growing. So the evolution of leaves over time and how quick those fossil records show the reduction of ridges indicate the height that existed at that moment. So when we determine the height of a mountain range or we determine where something was, we look at the vegetation fossils and they give us all the information based on the adaption to photosynthesis. And that's pretty much what I can tell you about North America. When the ice age retracted, when this ice shelf retracted, it forms all the river systems in the United States. So the Colorado River, the Ohio River, the Mississippi River, are all formed by the freshwater drip of these glaciers. There's so much freshwater coming that the freshwater goes to the Atlantic Ocean through what's called the St. Lawrence Seaway. So to do this again, you have the Laurentide Ice Shelf retracting, you have freshwater forming our river systems in what was a lake bed, you have water pouring into the Gulf of Mexico through the Mississippi, you've got water pouring into the Atlantic through the St. Lawrence Seaway, and it triggers an ice age. Because the freshwater spill into the Atlantic changes the salt component, the currents, and the 2 new ice ages that come back to North America are the older and younger Dryas, which essentially ended 15,000 years ago. So the only thing I can tell you is Florida was much larger when the ocean was 100 feet lower, and the ocean is 100 feet lower during an ice age, and Florida has been submerged in 4 different times, and Florida currently is beginning to become submerged again.
So you've told us how Florida was formed and what it's made out of. Can you tell us who the original inhabitants of Florida are?
Yeah. Most people think that Indians and American Indians were the inhabitants of North America. The first people in North America were called the Paleoclovis people, the Paleoclovis. They occupied the continent, including the Paleo-Indians, if you want to refer to them as that, Florida, up until about 13,000 years ago. And that's not a lot of years ago, it's 13,000. And there was a meteor strike over the Great Lakes, Lake Superior. The meteor strike, from what we have figured, really caused tremendous disaster to vegetation, tremendous disaster to the population. For practical purposes, it set North America on fire. At that time, the Paleo-Clovis people were essentially wiped out. At that time, 13,000 years ago, we were in the retraction of the last ice age, the Younger Dryas. The ocean was way lower than it is now, and there was a walking land bridge between Asia and North America. So people migrated into North America from Asia over a walking land bridge. Remember, when the ocean is 100 feet lower, there's a V system. So when you're up here, it's all the way across. But when the ocean's here, the distance of the oceans were half. So people able to get over, hopping islands that don't exist now, going, the idea that people couldn't cross the Pacific was one third the size. The Atlantic was half the size. So the migration came about 13,000 years ago to what you think is the American Indian. In Florida, the first Indians were not the Seminoles. They were called the Colusas. And the Colusa Indians lived here. And this is going back as far as 5,000 years ago. And then down the road, the Seminoles were the next people to occupy Florida.
So what you're saying was there was a lot of major changes in climates before humans?
You have to realize, and the question I was asked before, human beings may speed up a process, but if the process didn't exist throughout the history of the Earth, then it doesn't exist. But if the process has always existed before humans were remotely involved, and the arguments we're presenting, even in this podcast, about animal extinctions, about people extinctions, about the fact that North America as a continent is rotating counterclockwise every year. There are just so many factors. The fact that North America moves away from Africa 4 inches a year. 65 million years ago, reptiles roamed the planet. There was a meteor strike in the Yucatan Peninsula. That meteor strike annihilated the entire reptile population on the planet. If it wasn't for that strike, mammals would probably have not emerged to be the next predator or the next major group. Yellowstone, which is a supervolcano, blew off about 640,000 years ago in North America, changed the entire climate in North America. Yellowstone blew rocks 3 and 4 states away from its explosion. Yellowstone will at some point blow again. The most interesting of all the climate change circumstances is a volcano called Toba, coming from a place called Sumatra. The human population, which is only 200,000 years old, was wiped out, but for 10,000 breeding pair. They estimate, and there are different estimates, that 70,000 years ago, and we're not talking a million, we're not talking 2 billion, 70,000 years ago, that's half the time that humans have been populating the planet, the entire population of the human race was wiped down to between 2 and 10,000 breeding pairs. So if you think that climate change doesn't occur, vegetation changes, the Central America didn't exist, Hawaii didn't exist, it's a volcanic thing. The entire landscape and picture of the planet simply changes on a regular basis, but not in lifetimes that we measure, but in decades and centuries and larger periods that are really how planets should be measured.
So since Florida is submerging, what do you predict for the future of Florida? I know we are seeing, and I don't know if this plays a role in it either, but we're seeing more shark attacks. We're seeing more floods, more hurricanes. Should we all just sell our homes and move to somewhere else?
That's a great question. And that's going to occur whether you like it or not. And I'm going to, what we'll do, and we spoke about part two, about the effects in the future. Yeah, there will be massive migrations in Florida. And it's not because you should sell your home. You're not going to have a choice anyway. And there are things that are going to occur to the state by 2050 that are going to be beyond understanding, and they're there to be seen. So the question occurs is not whether we debate whether this will happen or not. We shouldn't be in the debate with who caused it or who didn't, who's responsible. Those are silly debates. What we should discuss is what's coming and what our alternatives are, whether we like it or we don't. You can change all the things you want to change, but you're not going to stop the outcome. It's too late. The outcome has been written, and it was written before man got here. It's just being sped up after man got here. So I think we can handle all those other things in part two. And I'm open to any other questions or...
What about slowing it down, maybe?
You can slow it down, but by 2050, what I will tell you is Galveston, Texas, and its area will be underwater. Norfolk, Virginia, and the Chesapeake area will be underwater. Atlantic City and Hoboken will be underwater. Miami and the Dade County area south of Miami will be underwater. Not they won't, maybe, not they could be, not they will be underwater by 2050 for a number of reasons. And you can't live in a place that's underwater. So you're going to have massive migrations of people moving from Dade County north.
What about New York?
New York has issues, but it's not the five most sensitive areas that I've outlined. New York is sea level, and it's going to have issues, and it's going to have water issues. Long Island, for example, was the end of a pile of dirt from a glacier, and that's all Long Island was. It's where the glacier line stopped. It's a little bit higher. Florida has some high points. It's not going to be completely submerged, but the coastal areas of Virginia, of Florida, of New Jersey, particularly because of land sinking and other issues like the Atlantic Ridge, are very susceptible to being underwater. There will be massive migrations. There'll be no fresh water. And we'll get into that in part two. And let's just go to whatever other parts you have.
Okay, I'm excited. So we've talked a lot of serious scientific and environmental issues. But a lot of our listeners, while we enjoy all of the education provided to us, a lot of our listeners enjoy us asking our guests pop culture questions. That's so good. Celine and I are going to indulge you with some pop culture questions, Prince. My first question is, what is your favorite song or songs of all time and why?
Oh, man. Blowing in the Wind, Bob Dylan, Life by Sly and the Family Stone. I don't know. I like Rotary Connection. Nobody even knows what they are, Aladdin. I like things that have good messaging. I like things that make you think. I like things that make you feel good. I like Bruno Mars. He always makes me feel good. I like rock and roll. I think Blowing in the Wind is an interesting song. It's a old song. So I don't know. I just like songs with good messaging, and separate from dancing, there's dance music and there's messaging music.
Okay. Speaking of dance music, when you were younger, what was your go-to dance move? I know this one from my parents.
Okay. I can do hustle. I can do Latin hustle. I can Lindy. I can bachang. I can rumba. I can samba. I can do the cha-cha. I can mambo. I can do single, double, and triple Lindy. I can waltz. So I took dance in school.
Okay. You should be on Dancing with the Stars.
There was nothing like that when we were there. But when we were younger, we would go to clubs. So in New York City, there was Ungano's, El Mio, the Ginza, the Rolling Stone. There was Undine's, there was Framis, there was Steve Folsom, there was Hippopotamus. But just some of the clubs that I danced at, separate from the Cheetah, Limelight, Palladium, and of course Studio 54, were all clubs we danced at. In those days, there were two ways you danced, either alone or together. And together meant the hustle or some version of Latin salsa. And so that's what we did.
Oh my, you are a party animal.
When you live in Manhattan, it's just a question of what time you get up and what time you go to sleep. And you do that by the sun. When the sun's up, you sleep. When the sun's down, you get up. And then you get burnt out. And then you move to Florida.
Okay, here's my next pop culture question. Growing up, who was your celebrity crush? And the reason why, and then right now, who is your celebrity crush?
Ally McGraw was pretty cool. There was a girl in the Mod Squad with blonde hair. I don't remember her name, but she was another one. I don't know, those two.
And how about now? Who's your celebrity crush?
That's a good question. I wouldn't even really know. That would be a really good question. In terms of, I don't know, Shakira is interesting, but she's not a crush. I don't know that I have celebrity crushes anymore. I just, there are people.
She's a celebrity. She's a celebrity.
She was pretty cool when she was on the Super Bowl. I don't know. I can't really think I have celebrity crushes. They're just people you find attractive for different reasons.
We're going to keep Shakira
as
your answer.
Yeah, she's cool.
Okay, I have a question, and it's a pop / political. If you could ask our current First Lady any question, what would you ask? And our former First Lady any question, what would you ask?
The current First Lady, I would ask her how she got to the point that she can put up with all this. Where she is, who she's with, what's going on. She has to be made of iron. If anyone ever deserved a medal, this woman deserves a medal for what she's put up with. Whatever she signed up for, and I understand she knew what she was doing, I don't know that she signed up to put her life in a fishbowl to the extent that it's become that. I wonder how it is to be a mother in this situation and raise a child and expect the child not to be affected. I would ask her what a horror it must have been to just want to go from wherever she was in her life to some better place and wind up in the middle of an absolute crossfire nightmare that makes a battlefield look peaceful. And if this is really what she wanted in her life, not that she has a choice. So I'd ask her how she got here. I ask her, I wouldn't expect an honest answer at the moment, but I'd ask her if she's had enough. So I think she's done, remarkable. I think you would think she thinks her job is to stay above all this, no matter what she thinks. Nobody seems to really know what she thinks. And I think that's remarkable that she's kept that under this kind of fire. With Michelle Obama, she's a different kind of lady. She is, by being more American and being more street smart and understanding the population better, she's more interactive. So you get a chance to see all the things she does. I just ask her what part she expected, what part she didn't expect as a first lady. What happened that she never thought? Was it the Christmas tree decorations? How she felt it affected her children? Were her children, what was better for her children because of this? And what's worse for her children because of this? So I think there's a human component that we never get to find out. We know what they say, we know what they look like, but what they think in terms of their children and their family, it must have a extraordinary large impact that we never know about.
Okay, Celine and I are going to ask you one more pop culture question each, and then we're going to end part one. My last pop culture question for you is, I know you're a renowned sneakerhead. So what is your favorite pair of sneakers of all time? Because I know Darren and I have given you some sneakers before for your great service. So I'm just curious, what's your favorite pair of sneakers?
Kashi is a great pair of sneakers. Kanai put out great sneakers. The ones I don't get are the standard brand stuff. The Red Bottoms, the Bhutans have some really great kind of spike sneakers, which I've got. Travel Fox. There are different sneakers from times that really come up. The Kanais were patent leathers with just absolutely gorgeous stuff in its time. And then through evolution, like the Kashis came out and they were the ones I have with sparkles and sequins and speckles. And to me, wardrobe to me is a fun game if it's played right. If it's not played to impress, but it's played to entertain, and people would understand the fun part of clothes is strictly entertainment, you can have so much expression and so much fun. And growing up in New York, we were what's called metrosexual, which means I don't care about color. I don't care about the fluff. I don't care about male and feminine. Metrosexual wasn't what your preferences were as a human being. It was what your preferences were in expression. And we just did it to the end all the time. When I came to Florida, it was like, what's wrong with you? Why are you wearing these things? And so I put them in the closet and got into shorts and a t-shirt.
Or I've seen you at different events before, and you dress to impress at some of the political events.
I dress to entertain. I try to every time find something new. I go out of my way to come and walk in and just knock it out. It's really in New York, we did that all the time. In Florida, there is no sense of style as much. In New York, every season, what the colors are that are in or out, how many buttons on a suit are in or out, the height of a dress hem. In New York, you know what last year is. You know the direction when coats are made, how many buttons, where they are, how wide. In Florida, there is no such thing. And in New York, there are, like it was at one time in Paris, like it was one time in California, there's a sense of yearly style. And we played it. We lived it. It was part of a norm. In Florida, the norm is simply as relaxed as possible. Style and clothing is irrelevant. So I use dress up as a time to go to my roots and just, again, if I can, hit it out of the park.
Yeah, spoken like a definite true New Yorker. And I definitely understand what you mean. I can spot a New Yorker in Florida a mile away just by how they're dressed.
I originally emigrated to this country from Brooklyn. I was born in Brooklyn, raised in Brooklyn. I emigrated to Florida. And English was supposed to be my first language, but when I didn't realize it, apparently it hadn't been. So, yeah, but New York is different. It's a different set of norms. People are quicker, a little more pushy. You know, in Florida, if you don't get in line in 10 seconds, you miss a spot. In New York, 10 seconds, you miss 10 spots. So people were more aggressive because the nature of the living circumstance, it's a little quicker. It doesn't make us smarter from New York, but it doesn't sometimes make us react more quickly to things. And living in Florida, you back off a drop and you start to be a little more relaxed and there's a little more community. And so there's a difference in the way we behave when we see people in supermarkets or restaurants, the loudness of the voices, the quickness of the responses. You can tell where people come sometimes from the way they're reacting to circumstances down here.
I don't know, pop getting in line in Poppy's during season gets a little brutal though, Prince.
And well, Debbie owns it and Ori runs it and we try to avoid the lines when possible, but we don't want to go there.
Okay, Selena, why don't you ask Prince one more question and we'll take this episode home.
Okay, Prince, I have to ask you this. How do you feel about, just because I constantly hear this and it's a social media dilemma, but how do you feel about all this inaccurate information being filtered through Facebook, through all sorts of social media platforms, because it's being called a social dilemma where it's a spew of misinformation and misinformation even about climate change?
Well, it's a great question. And it's probably a question you could talk for a half day on, but let's take it to where it is. Once upon a time, to be involved in a situation, you had to stand up, show up, and go somewhere. Once upon a time, if you wanted to be active in a community, you had to do things to get to that place. You were seen as a player character, and you would show up at a meeting or an event, and you would earn your place to speak, and you would gather information. The people who were more successful and most accurate and most contributing would have a status, and they developed where they would be heard. Social media has allowed a human being who is unqualified, doesn't participate, does next to nothing, sit with a keyboard, and now suddenly they're the loud speaker in a room because they have more time on the keyboard or they're more able to be more aggressive. So the people feeding information are not necessarily the contributors or the ones who've earned or the ones who participate, most often people who don't earn and don't participate. So the weeding out and the filtering of idiots doesn't occur on social media like it did in the old world where you looked in it, you acted in it, you were seen as an idiot. So the person in their bathrobe or the person in their kitchen who is socially angry, who is in life potentially a failure and makes bad decisions, who speaks with half information, is suddenly the spokesperson for something with the same equivalency or the equivalency of a person that really shouldn't has earned a place. So it's distorted who speaks, it distorts who we listen to. We don't know what's true or not because the young children aren't fact-checking and you can't really fact-check every conversation. I think social media has destroyed the nature of government. I think social media is destroying the nature of intelligent conversation. I think social media, because the people who govern the country don't understand it, can't govern it. We have no rules and regulations that are commensurate or that are equivalent to the problem. The people who could legislate this run the companies that are the creators of the problem. They're not going to legislate. It's not their job. So we have a government of people who don't understand the social media sophistication. They don't know TikTok and they don't understand Instagram and they don't understand any of this. And so we have a runaway system putting out bad information, creating not only an uneducated group, but actually giving bad education. And people who are swearing to facts that aren't facts at all, they're just someone's blog. Today I gave information, lots of it, in regard to climate. Maybe there's no Atlantic Ridge. Maybe there's no such thing as glacial rebound. And you can call it isotonic adjustment if you want to look it up. Maybe North America isn't moving away and didn't start as Pangaea. But the good part of social media, or internet, not social media, is you can fact check everything I said today. And I can say that the creation of Florida could be 350 million years or 340 million years, but that's where it was. So the good news of the internet, it allows us to check facts. The bad news of the internet, it allows untruths to become realities for kids who listen, who don't understand and can't discern. The bad part, of course, is the news media is as bad as the social media because it's no longer Walter Cronkite and Chet Huntley Brinkley, and it's no longer people, this is the news, that it's not, everybody has an opinion in between every news story. So I think the country is hurting dramatically for good information. Climate change is a victim of the exact situation. where they make a movie based on political garbage instead of incorporating the large picture and then saying man can do something. They just blame the whole thing on one party or another. It has nothing to do with party. Man is a contributor and we need to reduce our contribution, but the climate's changing. If all man got wiped out, there's still going to be another ice age.
Thank you so much, Prince, for all your time. And everybody stay tuned for part two, which will be available shortly.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Attorneys Are Human Too. Please subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast host. Please also leave us a 5-star review with your podcast provider. Hope you enjoyed this episode, and we look forward to seeing you next time.